Matthew 5, verses 33 through 37. The 23rd talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on June 26, 2016, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in some clipping of the presenter's words during the first half of the teaching.
Okay, we are continuing on with our study of Matthew. We're in the Sermon on the Mount. We're in chapter 5. Specifically, we're in that section that is sometimes called the antitheses. Jesus introduced this section by saying that our righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And then, from my perspective, he's been giving examples that explain what he means by that, in particular looking at the way the Pharisees justify their own righteousness in the way that they use the Old Testament. So far, we've seen Jesus say, "You've heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not commit murder.' You have heard it that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' You have heard it said, 'Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce.'" And then in each case, Jesus showed how the Pharisees had essentially trivialized the law. In each case, they had missed the deeper intention of God regarding those subjects. So today, in today's passage, we're going to talk about vows. Now, it might seem that this passage is going to be largely irrelevant to us. The practice of making vows belongs to that time and culture. I'm not saying that it never happens, but it was very common at that time. We don't much do it anymore, and probably largely because Jesus says not to do it here, so we've not been doing it. But is this passage applicable to us? What I usually hear from this, the lesson that I usually hear drawn from this, is Jesus is saying that we should just tell the truth all the time. Let your yes be yes and your no, no. Don't make vows. Well, fine. It's good advice. We should tell the truth all the time. I know that some Christians take this passage to be forbidding them from swearing in a court of law. They're not to take any vows, so they won't put their hand on the Bible and swear in a court. Beyond that, the question arises, I guess, as to what exactly are we going to get from this passage? It seems a little bit hard to get excited about it since it's not something that we do very often, if at all. I think, actually, though, maybe it's just me, but I find this to be one of the most interesting of the antitheses. I think there's a lot to talk about here. There's a very important issue being dealt with, and I think it's about more than just letting your yes be yes, about telling the truth or meaning what you say. So I hope to convince you today that this passage is very relevant to us. We're looking at Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 33. "Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord.' But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is of evil." Okay, so we'll start with the quotation from the Old Testament. Actually, it's not exactly a quotation. It seems to be the combining of several quotations, at least the ideas from several different passages. The language of the first part, "you shall not make false vows," probably comes most directly from Leviticus 19:12, which says, "You shall not swear falsely by my name so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." The second part that Jesus says here, "You shall fulfill your vows to the Lord," more literally something like, "You shall pay back your vows to the Lord." This language might be most directly related to Psalm 50, verse 14. Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and pay your vows Most High. Although there are several passages that it could be loosely tied to, there are a number of passages that say similar things to this, like Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Or Deuteronomy 23, 21. When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be sin in you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not sin you. You shall be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised. And even in Ecclesiastes 5:4, it says, when you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Okay, so these are the sorts of passages, I think, that Jesus has in mind when he says, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall pay back your vows to the Lord. Now, in the past several weeks, I've argued that Jesus is not critiquing or disagreeing with the Old Testament passages he quotes in this section. Rather, he is disagreeing with the way the Pharisees appeal to these passages in a misleading way. Specifically, the way the Pharisees defend their own righteousness by the way they use these passages. So, I think that's what's happening in this passage as well. In order to see that, we need to do three things. We're going to have to look at the practice of vows as we see it described in the Old Testament. We're going to need to look at what Jesus says about how the Pharisees are misusing these passages. And then finally, we want to try to understand what Jesus wants of us from all of this. What is our takeaway? What does he want us to do? So let's start by looking at the vows in the Old Testament. We're talking about passages that we would see the English translations would say things like making a vow, swearing by someone or something, taking an oath, that kind of language. There are actually several different practices that come under this heading. Let me start with a common one. One sort of vow is the promise made directly to God, often in connection with a prayer for help. So a classic example is the story of Jacob, who's on the run from his brother Esau, and he's on a journey to find a wife. Remember, he comes to this certain place, and he uses a stone for a pillow, and he sleeps there, and he has this dream about angels going up and down a ladder to heaven. So in Genesis 28:12, we read about the next morning. So Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on its top. He called the name of that place Bethel, or the house of God. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. So Jacob is asking for God's protection in this arduous journey he's taking, and if God should provide it, then Jacob is promising various acts of religious devotion in response. Such vows do not have to be associated with requests. You can make a vow just as an expression of thanks for something that God has already done. These sorts of vows, these promises to God, ultimately become part of the sacrificial system itself. People would make a vow to God that certain offerings would be made at the temple. Psalm 66:13 makes this connection very clear. I shall come into your house with burnt offerings. I shall pay you my vows, which my lips uttered and my mouth spoke when I was in distress. I shall offer to you burnt offerings of fat beasts with the smoke of rams. I shall make an offering of bulls with male goats. Okay, so here we see this connection. I am going to be making offerings to you in the temple, and these are the payment of the vows that I made when I was in distress. I called out to you probably saying, I'm in trouble, help me, and I promised that I will sacrifice so much stuff to you at the temple. Okay, now I'm going to pay my vows. There are a number of passages like these in the Old Testament that connect paying back a vow with making some sort of an offering in the temple. I think the Nazirite vow is a vow sort of like this. So the person vows these things to God for a set period of time, for some certain period of time. I will not cut my hair. I will not drink alcohol. I will stay away from dead bodies, even if someone in my family dies. At the end of the period of the vow, I will shave my head and put the hair in the fire, and then I will make various sorts of offerings at the temple, and then I will have fulfilled my, if I've done all those things. Okay, so all of these are examples of a certain sort of vow, a promise to God that the worshiper is going to do something, usually some religious act like a sacrifice, sometimes conditional upon God responding to the worshiper's prayer. Now, a story from 1 Samuel 19 and 20 gives us a different picture of vows. So let me tell you this story first. Remember, at this time, Saul is the king of Israel. Saul is jealous of David, who is destined to become king of Israel. And Jonathan is the son of King Saul, but also the best friend of David. So in 1 Samuel 19, Saul tells his son Jonathan to have David killed. Jonathan pleads with his father not to do this, not to have David killed. And so in 19:6, we read Saul's response. Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, "As Yahweh lives, he shall not be put to death." And yet, later on, Saul seeks to have David killed again. David tells Jonathan about this, and Jonathan doesn't believe David at first. Jonathan says, "Hey, my dad would have told me if he were going to do something like that to you." But David goes on to insist that it is true. So in chapter 20, verse 3, "Yet David vowed again, saying, 'Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as Yahweh lives, and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death.'" So Jonathan hears David's vow that he's telling the truth, and he believes him. And he tells David that he's going to go back and check with the old man and see what's going on. Let me see what's happening. And so in 20:12, it says, "Then Jonathan said to David, 'Yahweh, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow, or the third day, behold, if there is good feeling toward David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? But if it please my father to do you harm, may Yahweh do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety." Okay, so there are three vows in this story. Let's talk about David's vow first. David vows and says, "As truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I'm telling the truth, Saul is trying to kill me." This is an oath, like what we might say in a court of law. David is swearing that he is not lying. He is a witness to Saul's attempts to kill him. He is telling the truth. And David invokes the name of God as he makes his oath. "As certainly as God lives, I am telling the truth. In fact, as certainly as your soul lives, Jonathan, I am telling the truth." These sorts of oaths are common. Saul's vow, however, is different. Saul vowed, "As Yahweh lives, David shall not be put to death." Saul's vow is a promise to Jonathan. He is telling Jonathan, "I heard you. I am not going to have David put to death." And he is invoking the name of God to establish the certainty of his promise. Now, We know it didn't turn out so well. Ultimately, Saul tried to kill David again. We can't exactly say that he lied, because when he said it, he meant it. He intended to this promise. He intended to keep it. But what we can say is that Saul broke his vow. Saul invoked God in his promise to Jonathan that he would not try to kill David, and yet later Saul tries to kill David. Saul broke his promise to Jonathan, and he broke his vow that he made before God. Jonathan also makes a vow. It's a similar sort of thing. It is also a promise. He's making a promise to David. He says, "May Yahweh, the God of Israel, be witness." He says, "If it turns out that Saul wants to harm you, David, may Yahweh do so to Jonathan and more also if I do not make it known to you and send you away that you may go in safety." Okay, so Jonathan is promising David that he will faithfully report if he finds out that Saul is seeking to kill David. He's saying, "I will tell you." He is saying explicitly in this vow, I think, what is sort of implicit in all vows that invoke God. He is, as they say, swearing to his own hurt. That is, he is vowing, "May God do terrible things to me if I break my promise. If I don't tell you that Saul is after you when I find out, then may God do even worse things to me." That's the vow that he's saying. Both Saul and Jonathan are making the sorts of vows that we see many times in the Old Testament, because it's a very common thing for one person to make promises to another person about future behavior. They are invoking God as a witness as to whether they're going to keep their promises or not. They are either implicitly or explicitly calling on God to punish them if they break their word. So I just picked a couple. There's a bunch of them in the Old Testament. Abraham makes his servant take a vow in Genesis 24:1. Now Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, "Please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites." But he wants, instead, "You will go to my country and to my relatives." Okay, so he's making him swear by the Lord that he will not do this one thing, that he will do this other thing instead. We see Saul make David take a vow in 1 Samuel 24:21. Saul says to David, "Now behold, I know that you will surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hand. So now swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's household." And David swore to Saul. Again, he's asking David to swear by Yahweh, by the Lord, that he will not do this one thing in the future, that he will do this other. In all of these cases, the person is making a promise to someone else, a commitment concerning his future behavior, and swearing by God that he will keep that promise. Even God himself makes promises and then swears to them. The famous one is in Genesis 22:15. "Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, 'By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice.'" So you may recall that the book of Hebrews makes an interesting comment about this vow that God made. In Hebrews 6:13, it comments, "For when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, 'I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you.' And so, having patiently waited, he obtained the promise. For men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath given as confirmation is an end to every dispute." In the same way, God, desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. Okay, so I think that the author of Hebrews has captured an important aspect of these sorts of vows. It says, men swear by one greater than themselves. And with them, an oath given as confirmation is the end of every dispute. So if I merely make a promise on my own, you might wonder, so who are you, and why should I be inclined to believe that you're actually going to keep this promise that you make? But if I invoke someone greater than myself, that is, God, then my promise takes on more weight. I am calling God to witness my promise to you. I am making myself vulnerable to God's judgment if I fail to keep it. Okay, so to sum up this Old Testament picture, we've seen three sorts of vows. There is the vow directly to God, usually a promise to make certain temple sacrifices or commit particular religious acts. There is the oath that my testimony is true. I'm telling the truth. I am an eyewitness. It happened just as I am saying, I swear to God. And there is the promise that one person makes to another about the future. I promise you that I will do X. As God is my judge, I will keep my word. Okay, so now let's turn back to Matthew 5 then. Before we sort out Jesus' argument, let me just make a preliminary observation. It's very interesting to me that we see in the behavior of the Apostle Paul examples of him doing the sort of stuff that we just looked at Old Testament, which makes me think right from the beginning that we want to be careful. I don't think that Jesus actually is setting out to disagree with and forbid all vows in terms of the way the Old Testament talked about them. First of all, we see Paul participating in the practice of making religious vows to God. He made one himself. We don't know why, but in Acts 18, it says that he cuts his hair because he was keeping a vow, presumably some sort of a Nazarite-like vow for a limited period of time where he said he wasn't going to cut his hair, and then at the end he cuts it all off, and presumably with other promises and offerings associated with it. And in Acts 21, there is this interesting story about Paul in Jerusalem. Paul has come back to Jerusalem where his reputation has become very bad with the Jews because he converted to Christianity. He's a follower of Jesus. And the Jews there have interpreted that as a complete rejection of his Judaism. Paul is accused of teaching Jews to abandon their Judaism. And so James and the elders in Jerusalem ask Paul to prove that he's not hostile to Judaism. We want you to do something to demonstrate to the Jews here in Jerusalem that you have not abandoned your Jewishness. So James and the elders say, look, we got these four guys. They have made a vow. It is time for them to go to the temple and pay off their vow, presumably make offerings and stuff, perhaps a Nazarite vow again. It is the time for them to go do what they had promised. And so they're saying, what we want you to do, Paul, is we want you and pay their vow. So we've got two examples of Paul's participation in the practice of making vows, religious vows to God. So he doesn't seem to think that there's anything forbidden about doing it. And then we see Paul, what seems to me as the best way to interpret, is that he is making these oaths that basically say, I am telling the truth. We see it in a number of places. Let me just rattle off some places. I won't bother with the citations. I'm just going to give you a few examples here. For God, whom I serve in my spirit in the preaching of the gospel of his Son, is my witness as to how unceasingly I make mention of you, always in my prayers making request. But I call God as witness to my soul that to spare you I did not come again to Corinth. Now, in what I am writing to you, I assure you before God that I am not lying. For we never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. God is witness. For God is my witness, how I long for you all with the affection of Christ Jesus. So this is Paul's way, fairly common way, of saying, I am telling the truth. I call God as my witness. Before God, I'm saying to you that this is true, the thing that I'm telling you about. So it doesn't seem like Paul sees anything wrong with making that sort of oath, with invoking God as witness to the truth of what he's saying. So even before we look at what Jesus says, I'm kind of open to the possibility that there's something a little more complicated going on in what Jesus says than might first be apparent. Okay, so let's take a look then, and let's see what we find. Let me read the passage again from Matthew 5. Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is of evil. Okay, so as I've been arguing for several weeks, I think we need to take the opening statements when Jesus talks about what you have heard to be saying something like this. You have heard the Pharisees, when they tried to justify themselves as righteous men, tell you that the scriptures say you shall not make false vows, but fulfill your vows to the Lord. So Jesus is not so much talking about the Old Testament teaching on vows. He is talking about the way the Pharisees use the teaching on vows. And though it may not be immediately apparent, I think this is confirmed by what Jesus goes on to say, that he in fact has the Pharisees in mind when he says, don't swear by heaven, don't swear by Jerusalem, don't swear by your head. Now, why would I say that? That he doesn't mention the Pharisees there anywhere. But I think, in fact, he is implying that his language is right at the Pharisees, and let me explain what I mean by that. There's a very important passage later in Matthew 23:16. In this section, Jesus is pronouncing a series of woes upon the scribes and the Pharisees. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you devour widows' houses. Woe to you because you tithe mint and dill and cumin, but neglect justice and mercy, and so forth. And in Matthew 23:16, we read, woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And you say, whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, whoever swears by the altar swears both by the altar and by everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears both by the temple and by him who dwells within it. And whoever swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. Okay, so this is language aimed specifically at the practices of the Pharisees. And here's the situation as I understand it. The scribes and the Pharisees often dealt with the question, what exactly does the law require? How do you decide whether you're a righteous person in terms of what the law requires? In this case, I think the situation that the Pharisees are ruling on is this third type of vow that we discussed in the Old Testament, the promise sort of vow. I'm making a promise to another person that I'm going to do some particular thing. But now, that first person who made the promise has reneged, didn't keep the promise that was made. And yet they made a vow when they made the promise. So where does that leave things? Legally, and by legally, we're talking about in terms of the law, in terms of the God's revealed will in the law. Well, the person only swore by the temple. The rabbi looks at this and rules. He swore by the temple. He didn't swear by the gold of the temple, so he's not obligated. He is not breaking the law. He can still be a righteous person, even though he didn't keep the promise, because he didn't swear by the temple. He didn't swear by the gold of the temple. He only swore by the temple. Or he swore by heaven. He didn't swear by God or by the name of God. He swore by heaven. And so he's still righteous as far as the law is concerned if he doesn't pay it back. We have historical confirmation that this was a real debate among the Pharisees. There's an entire book of the Mishnah, the writings of the Jewish rabbis, that deals with these sorts of questions. In that book, the rabbis say that if you swear by heaven and earth, it is not binding. If you swear by the life of your head, it says in that book, some rabbis say, yes, that's binding. Others say, no, it's not. That is, are you guilty before the law if you haven't kept your promise when you vow by heaven and earth? No, you're okay. Now, if you had sworn by God, then you're stuck, because that's clearly against the law. And again, these probably arise from specific cases where people made these vows and then didn't keep them. And so the rabbis are ruling on where do things stand here legally. The Pharisees quote the passages that say you must pay back your vows to the Lord. So that's the key. That's how you tell. If you have made a commitment invoking the name of the Lord, then you are stuck. You have to keep it, because the law says you have to keep your vows that are made in the name of the Lord. That's what the law says. But what if you didn't use the words, I swear by God, I swear in the name of the Lord? What if you swear by heaven? Or what if you swear by Jerusalem? Well, okay, now we can have a debate. The law doesn't specifically say anything about that, so we can debate as to whether you're guilty or not, whether you are still obligated to keep the promise that you made by making this vow. So this is the situation that Jesus is speaking to, as I understand it. Once again, Jesus is challenging the way the Pharisees used the law. Jesus is denouncing the approach that says, let's find out exactly what the rules are. If we keep our behavior within those rules, then we are righteous people. And he's saying that they are really missing the point of what the Old Testament is trying to get at when it comes to these matters. Okay, so now the hardest question is, what does Jesus want? What is he telling us to do? Or maybe another way to put it is, what is the greater truth that the Pharisees are missing in this? This passage is sometimes taught as if the main point is that we are straightforward and honest in our dealing with people. Don't try to get out of your commitments through trickery, or don't try to a vow as some sort of means of getting your way. Just say what you mean and mean what you say. In other words, the focus is on how we treat other people. Don't be manipulative. Don't make promises that you don't intend to keep. Tell the truth. That's the righteous and loving thing to do. Well, obviously, of course, that's true, and it does have a certain relevance, obviously, in this passage, but I think Jesus' emphasis is elsewhere. He is not so much emphasizing how we deal with other people. He is talking about how we deal with God, as I understand his point. Okay, so sure, there is another person involved here. We make these sorts of vows when we're trying to convince the other person that we're going to do something in the future. Loaning money is a real obvious kind of example. We say, loan me money now, and in the future, I will pay you back with 10% interest. What? You don't trust me? You don't think I'm good for it? Let me give you some collateral. My soul. I swear to God that I will pay you this money back. May God judge me if I do not pay you back this money. You may not find me trustworthy, but I am appealing to something bigger than myself. I'm calling on God to be the judge of our transaction. Okay, well, that's all fine and good if I, the person making the vow, actually do take God seriously. But what if all I really care about is convincing you to loan me the money? Judgment someday by God is very abstract and far away, but my need for money today is immediate and pressing. Sure, I'll swear to God if that's what it takes. The consequences are only theoretical.
And hey, maybe even non-existent. Maybe it just won't come to anything at all. Meanwhile, I need the money. So I'm going to use this religious vow as a means of convincing you to loan me the money that I want, or whatever the issue might be. I would argue that this is a classic case of violating the third commandment. Exodus 27, 20, verse 7 says, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain." I think some people have the impression that to take God's name in vain means using profanity. So if I say, "God damn it," or "oh my God," or something like that, I'm using the word God, but I'm not really using it very seriously. I'm not really talking to God or talking about God. It's just kind of an offhand sort of curse or whatever. It's just sort of rhetoric. And so I'm taking God's name in vain. I don't think that's what the commandment is about. That's not what the point is. To take God's name in vain is to use his name in a way that sounds like we really mean it, but in fact, we don't. I don't think I'm going to get myself in trouble with this comment. I don't mean to get myself in trouble with this comment, but I couldn't help thinking of the current presidential election stuff that's going on, because I see candidates saying, "I'm a very religious person, but my opponent is not. I take my religion much more seriously than the other person does." And everybody knows, I'm not meaning to insult anybody or anything, but everybody knows, right? What they're really interested in is convincing me to vote for them. That's the goal in this deal here. So I would say that that's a classic case of taking the name of the Lord in vain. It sounds like the speaker is serious about God, but in fact, he's really serious about something else. Well, that is what swearing by the name of God can be like. "May God judge me if I don't pay back this money." Well, actually, I don't really fear God. I am not really concerned about the judgment that will come if I don't pay it back. I'm just trying to convince you to give me the money now. I am using the name of God to accomplish my own worldly purposes. That is how I understand what it means to take the name of God in vain. The commandment against swearing falsely in Leviticus 19:12 gives a very similar sort of rationale. It says, "You shall not swear falsely by my name so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. I am Yahweh." So if you swear by the name of God and yet you break your vow, which means you don't really take God very seriously when you make this vow to him, you are profaning the name of God. You are treating God, who is holy and above all, as if he were something common, as if it was no big deal to promise the creator of the universe, your judge, to promise him that you're going to do something and then say, don't think I will. It's to profane his name, to treat him as if he's just something like anything else. No big deal if I swear by God's name. If I don't feel like keeping my vow, I won't. So again, the rationale in Leviticus 19, you will profane the name of your God if you swear falsely by his name, I think is very much related to the idea of taking the name of God in vain. It is to use God's name in a way that at first seems serious and then only turns out to be worldly and unbelieving. Well, it is this fundamental truth that the Pharisees are downplaying, as I understand the nature of Jesus' complaint against them. They know that the rules say that they are not supposed to swear falsely by the name of God. So, okay, they won't use the name of God when they swear. But they are clearly trying to accomplish the same sort of worldly end. Okay, you don't trust me? Okay, so I can't vow to God using the name of God, because then I'm really going to have to pay it back. But I am going to appeal to something bigger. I will swear by heaven or by Jerusalem. I am clearly implying that I am calling upon the God of heaven, the God who is worshipped in Jerusalem. And yet, if I don't end up keeping my vow, I am still a righteous man because I didn't swear in the name of the Lord. That's against the rules. You can't not keep your vow if you swear in the name of the Lord. Swear by heaven, swear by Jerusalem, we can talk. Okay, so my contention is this. Jesus is charging the Pharisees with taking the name of the Lord in vain, even though they didn't actually say the words, the name of the Lord. Their goals are worldly. They want to convince someone to do something for them, like loan me some money or whatever. So they say, I swear by heaven that I will pay you back. They are trivializing the very serious act of vowing. They don't see themselves as making commitments with God as their witness. They are using religious-sounding vows as a way to accomplish their own worldly purposes, or at least they're opening the door for such behavior. Okay, so if I'm right about this, then there are two things to take away from Jesus' teaching, two things that we want to talk about ultimately, about what does this tell us, what can we derive from this. First of all, we need to talk about his specific instruction here about vows. Don't do it. He is speaking into the specific situation where the Pharisees are ruling on whether certain vows are obligatory or not based on how they relate to the rules in the law. I think that is the issue that he's talking about. They are inclined to justify themselves as righteous even though they haven't kept their promise because they didn't use the magic words in the name of the Lord. That really would have been against the rules. And Jesus is saying, I don't want you to follow them in this. Better not to make a vow at all. I don't think Jesus is speaking to the issue of, say, a Nazirite vow or something like that, making certain vows to God that I will make certain religious commitments, I will do certain religious practices. Person can still make this vow for 30 days. I'm not going to drink any alcohol. I'm not going to cut my hair. I'm not going to go near to any dead bodies. And at the end, I will cut my hair off and I'll make sacrifices at the temple. Nothing in what Jesus says here would preclude something like that, as I understand the logic of what he's getting at. And as we know, Paul participated in that stuff, and he didn't seem to have a problem with it. I also don't think that Jesus is speaking to the issue of taking an oath, as Paul did. Like we saw, Paul often says something like, as God is my witness, I am telling you the truth. Again, according to the logic and the issue that Jesus is addressing here, I don't think he's suggesting that there's anything wrong with that. Which, by the way, would mean, if I'm right in the logic that he's getting at here, there is nothing wrong with swearing in a court of law. To swear, I am telling the truth, my testimony, I saw this, and so help me God, this is what I saw. That's the sort of thing Paul did. I don't think that there's anything in what Jesus is saying that would suggest that there's anything wrong with that. In fact, I'm not inclined to think that Jesus intends to forbid all promissory vows. That is, I don't think he is forbidding all vows that I will behave a certain way in the future. I don't think that he would have seen anything wrong with Jonathan saying to David that he's swearing before God, may God do worse to me if I break my promise and fail to fully inform you what it is that's going on with Saul. If you know me to be serious about my relationship with God, then you know how seriously I have decided to do this thing for you. We see Paul saying, as God is my witness, I am telling the truth. I don't see in principle why Paul couldn't say he's writing to a church that has done him serious wrong. I don't see why he couldn't say to them, as God is my witness, I am not going to retaliate against you or something like that. It is describing the decision that this person has made as to how they are going to respond and saying, this is how serious it is that I in fact intend to do that. God is my witness that this is what I am going to do. Where the rub starts to come in is in those specific kinds of vows that I think the Pharisees were concerned with. Typically, we're talking about legal sorts of situations. The issue is, I have vowed to pay you something or to do something for you, but now I can't do it. I owe you money, but I don't have the money, so I can't pay you back or something like that. But I convinced you to loan the money to me in the first place by swearing. I swear by heaven that I will pay you back. The person really had no business making a vow of that kind. How can I promise before God what will happen in the future when I cannot control the future? How can I promise before God, how can I swear to my own hurt that I will pay you back when I can't guarantee that I will be able to raise the money? So, at minimum, we have Jesus' specific command here, don't use the name of God or heaven or anything else, implying that you are invoking God as a means of manipulating people into doing what you want. Just let your yes be yes. That is, say, when it comes to such promises, if you loan me this money, I am promising that I will do my best to pay you back as I have said. If that's not enough, if you will take nothing less than my assurance that may God strike me dead if I don't give you the money, then tough. I'm going to have to do without it. He is at least saying that much. And I think more significantly, the issue is not really the vow itself. The issue is this issue of the third commandment of taking the name of the Lord in vain. The problem is thinking of yourself as a righteous person when you are using God as a tool to try to get your way with other people. Don't take the name of the Lord in vain, I think, is the general principle that Jesus is appealing to here. Don't talk about God as if he matters when, in fact, you are just trying to accomplish your own worldly ends. You and I need to acknowledge how tempting it can be to use God in this way. This is where I think the true relevance of what is being said comes to us here, because it's not just specifically about how you make promises to people, but it is coming back to how we treat God as we are dealing with other people, whether we are treating God as seriously as he needs to be treated, whether we are thinking about him as seriously as we need to think about him. Because we live in this world, we would like things to go well for us, and sometimes playing the God card can pay off. Sometimes invoking God's name in some way can do things in this world. Sometimes our religious posturing can win us rewards. But to do such things is to take the name of the Lord in vain. It is to forget who's in charge and what's important. And to do such things is what Jesus is fundamentally charging the Pharisees with. As I understand it, his fundamental complaint is they have misunderstood the importance and scope of the third commandment, that they not take the name of the Lord in vain. What you and I have to come to terms with is that God is really there. He really is the judge of heaven and earth. He really does hold my eternal destiny in his hands. So the question should never really be, how can I use God to get this world to pay off? The question is, where do I stand before the God who is my judge and my savior? So if you have any comments or questions, feel free.
This is really interesting, Ron, what you said about them skirting around the name of God and playing on technicalities. That sounds pharisaical, and it does make a lot more sense of it. Just a question, would they have experienced a dynamic where making a vow by a certain weighty, what you would call reference, in any way obligated the person they were making the vow to respond positively?
Not that I'm aware of. That could be, I don't know one way or the other. I suspect it's hard to imagine that that would be true, because that really then, the vow becomes a super tempting tool of manipulation. If I've invoked the name of God, you have no right to deny me. That would, everybody would be using it, I think.
But so. Don't we do that in some ways?
Well, yeah. Right. I just think it was probably a little subtler than that. But.
Thanks, Ron. I think Karina might have had this question a few months ago, last time you taught, but I can't remember what you said, so I'm asking again.
Okay.
It's just a general question. I'm with you on your sort of summary statement for what this section is about. The Pharisees don't take God seriously. Are you seeing this tie into the first, 10 to 12 verses of the chapter? And if so, how are you seeing the connection?
Right. I am not seeing it tied as in one follows from the other. That is, at my understanding right now, and I may be wrong about this, I know there are other ways of putting this together, but my understanding right now I could see certain units of the Sermon on the Mount, if they had been switched and given in a different order, that fundamentally it wouldn't change the meaning of what he's doing. That I see the units, they are related to a central purpose. So it does follow from the first part in the sense that we are really talking about what is the reality in contradistinction to the teaching of the Pharisees that is so common among them. What is the actual calling to be a person who's following God? What is that actually about? So the Beatitudes in the beginning give this general sort of statement of these are the blessed ones. It is the people who have this sort of attitude, this sort of stance toward God. And that kind of captures the essence of what he's trying to get at. Now we're going to deal with different kinds of problems. And here, with the antitheses, he's taking on that I may be charged with setting aside the law because I'm not agreeing with the Pharisees, but in fact, I have come to fulfill the law. I'm here in support of everything that it says. It is the Pharisees who have set aside the law by the way that they use it. And now he goes through these examples. So this is in contradistinction to the sort of person that I have just described in the Beatitudes. Here's what the Pharisees are doing, and you don't want to follow them in that. Then after this, the next section talks about the hypocrites. You don't want to be like the hypocrites who, and it's a similar sort of theme, but who practice religious practices. They pray or they give alms, that you don't want to do these religious practices in such a way that the point of them is what you get in this life out of them, instead of something else. So each of these units then is related to this general theme of, as opposed to what the Pharisees are doing, what does it really look like? What is it that God is actually looking for from people? So in that sense, they are tied, but I wouldn't say that I can go from this verse to this verse and say, and this obviously follows from it tightly, something like that. If that is true, I'm not seeing it. Anything else? Okay, well, thanks. Thanks for coming. So we'll finish up the antitheses next week.